Okay. Next one bar set of batteries. So as I was saying, the overall picture, of course, the overall theme is the theme of prophethood. But if we, by at any time during the series, if there's something you want me to look at in more detail, it doesn't have to be at the very end. If something occurs to you, just let me know. And if by the end we haven't covered it adequately or enough or whatever, I'm happy to tack that on to the end. I think that would be really good. So be sure to do that. So last or 2 weeks ago, I guess it was, or is it last week? I can't remember. I digressed for maybe half an hour, 45 minutes or something like that on Arabic, only because I want to do justice to the terms involved. We were going to encounter lots of names, and heck, we've encountered several terms up to now too, right? Quran, for example. I want to spell these things correctly, and I talked about the 28 consonants and the Arabic alphabet and the diacritics that serve for the six vowels, and I simply and the transliterations. I've watched a few videos on how to write Arabic and so forth. I'm not even going to get into that, but I just want to transliterate them correctly, and they all have standard romanization equivalents, and I want to make sure I do that, and I just want to get it correct. And there's a lot of sloppiness out there, so anyway, it's hard. Sometimes hard to find a correct spelling of something. But at any rate, so I spent a good long time talking about that. And then we spent maybe another half an hour or so talking about some of the peculiarities of Quran, the fact that there's an enormous variability in the length of the surahs, the strange abbreviations you find in verse 2 sometimes, sometimes not. We talked about the titles and the fact that the titles are pretty insignificant in the sense that they don't really convey what's inside. They're just ways of identifying the surahs. Normally, I mean, somebody, a Muslim, I'm sure, doesn't do what I do and identify the surah just by the number. To me, that's what's meaningful. But to them, I'm sure, the cow. Okay, that's surah number 2. They would know immediately where to go to get that. Kind of like the books of the Bible in some ways, kind of, a little bit, but not that much. But they're more like identifiers too. At any rate, and so then I talked, but then the last topic that I'm still in the middle of is talking about the history behind the Quran. And so I talked about the life of Muhammad. I actually got through with that, but I want to carry it just a little farther than that.
I want to too, yes.
And So we talked about, I talked about the fact that, Muhammad was a native of Mecca, and he was orphaned fairly early. He belonged to the Quraysh tribe, Quraysh, I believe it is. And then I guess the most significant thing that happened to him early on was when he was 25 and married Khadija. And she was his wife of, 24 years or so before she died in 619. Muhammad's dates are somewhere around 570. We're not sure exactly when he was born, to 632. Okay, we do know when he died. And of course, around 610 or so, and this is what Tom and I were talking about before class, he started getting these visions that maybe, to answer Tom's question again, maybe were ex post facto identified as coming from the angel Gabriel. Because, as Tom said, reasonably, well, golly days, this was a pagan society, polytheistic society, and probably at the very outset he was a polytheist, right? And all of a sudden he's told, wait a minute, there's only one God whose name is Allah, who is the supreme God in the polytheistic religion of Mecca. The Bedouins, I guess they are out there. And so maybe, looking back on it, he would have seen it to be, and I can't remember if the name I'll have to check. I can check. If the name Gabriel comes up in the Quran, maybe it does. Just don't remember. Well, anyway, his message, and this is the most important thing, I think, and this is what kind of underlies the whole business. His message was not the kind of thing people wanted to hear, obviously, because basically his message was, well, you guys, you've been wrong for centuries. I mean, this traditional religious practice that went back as far as anybody could remember, he's coming along and saying, this is all wrong. There's only one God, and I'm going to tell you, you know, what this one God expects of you, and you better toe the line, right? This did not make him popular. There were some converts, of course, but and including his wife, who's traditionally his first convert. But at any rate, yes, he was very unpopular. And his tribe eventually, in about 618 or so, eventually basically just rejected him. And they almost put a target on his back by saying, okay, well, we're going to withdraw our normal protection from you. If somebody kills you, we will not take revenge. I mean, that is almost to say you're basically, well, we'll tolerate your presence, I guess, but, you know, you're a persona non grata here in this tribe. He spent some time thereafter trying to make an arrangement with another city, At-Ta'if. That fell through. The three first divisions of the surah, chronological divisions of the surahs in the Quran, which are early Meccan, middle Meccan, and late Meccan, are punctuated respectively by the first part, and then he gets blackballed by his tribe. That's the beginning of the middle Meccan period. And then then the start of the negotiations with At-Ta'if is the middle Meccan period. And then at that point, it's the beginning of the late Meccan period. And when that finally fell through...
Sorry for the noise. It's going to be temporary.
Okay. That's the late Meccan period. I don't put that much stock in the distinction between early, middle, and late Meccan. The really important distinction is between Meccan and Medinan. Because in 622, as I said, things got so bad that he actually fled from Mecca to Medina. And that, of course, as you know now, is the beginning of the Islamic calendar. That's the zero point of the Islamic calendar, which is a lunar calendar. And this is what makes all the difference, because it's this point that everything turns violent, and you have these military conflicts between Mecca and Medina, and the forces from the two cities. In 630, finally, Mecca was captured by the Medinan forces. Muhammad was victorious. He went on. I mean, it's almost like you start this ball rolling and, you know, it just kind of keeps on going. Next thing you know, the entire Arabian Peninsula has been brought under the banner of Islam. And then that ball kept on rolling even after Muhammad's death. I mean, once this military expansion starts going, it just will keep going until it finally exhausts itself. I guess. Well, not even that, but finally it meets with the limits of what it can do. I talked about the four righteous caliphs, Abu Bakr, Umar, and Uthman, and Ali. And the expansion kept going. By the early 8th century, basically the expansion in the east was stopped when they tried to besiege Constantinople and failed. And in the west, of course, as you know, Charles Martel, Battle of Tours in early 8th century. 632 is what sticks in my mind, but I don't know if that's right or not. That was the...
Don, 732.
That's what I said, isn't it?
As you've said, 632.
Oh, okay, well, yeah, 732, right, because it's the early 8th century. Anyway, that, of course, halted the expansion in the West, from your perspective over here in the West. So we have, in both cases, it was roughly about the same time in the East and in the West, we have the boundaries sort of set up. sort of between, say, Syria and Asia Minor over here and the Pyrenees Mountains over here. It's the limit of the expansion of Islam. But I want to tell you now about some of the internal things that were going on, and then I'll come back to the general historical question. Ali's death created the beginnings of the most consequential schism in Islam, and that had to do with the question of who should succeed the prophet, who is the proper caliph. A caliph is just a successor of the prophet. Does the caliph have to be a part of the prophet's family in some way or other, or alternatively, should the caliph be somebody who is selected, just the best candidate maybe, or a hereditary figure or what have you? That was really the central issue. And so let me put some names on the board. I got to make sure I spell them right too. So, Ali had two sons, or at least two sons who figure into this story. The Dot. And another Dot. Hassan and Hussein. Then there was another guy. I definitely have to look at my notes here to get his name spelled correctly. Yeah, okay. Muawiyah. I got that right? Nope. No, we don't. Wait a minute. Muawiyah. Yes. Who was related to, actually, Uthman, the third of the righteous caliphs. The question of the succession after Ali died came up. Basically, it was Hassan versus Muawiyah, and Hassan magnanimously, and of course from a purely Machiavellian standpoint, stupidly, magnanimously decided to abdicate in favor of Muawiyah for the sake of unity, so that there would not be, you know, any sort of civil war or bloodshed or anything like that. But the agreement that was made was that then Muawiyah would rule, and then when he died, Hussein would be the successor of that. So that was the, you know, agreement that was set up. Well, I'm sure I don't even have to continue the story for you to figure out what happened. Muawiyah had a son named Yazid. No, I'm pretty sure it's just... Let me check. Oop, nope. All right. Yazid. And after Muawiyah died, Yazid took over. Needless to say, at that point, warfare broke out, and Hussein was killed at the Battle of Karbala. And that's in 680. That event is celebrated to this day. And you may have read about it or seen it on the news by Shiites, lamenting the death of Hussein, the proper successor, ultimately, to the Prophet. This is what underlies, of course, the eventual split between the what we now call the Shiites and the Sunnis. The Shiites are the party that's with a... The Shiites are the party that say that the successor to the Prophet has to be in the Prophet's family. Ali was Muhammad's son-in-law. So, not necessarily a direct descendant, but in the family. And then the Sunnis, of course, are the ones who say that, no, that's not necessary, that there are other criteria by which we determine who is the caliph, who is the successful prophet. I might add here that both Muawiyah and Yazid actually properly should have a Roman numeral after them, because this, see, before Muawiyah, we didn't have a dynasty. But you see here now we have the emergence of a dynasty. And that's the Umayyads. I think it's a Aleph. Let me just check. Make sure I got all my spelling. Yes, it's an Aleph. And that's the first caliphate. The first genuine caliphate in the sense of a dynastic succession. And the reason, of course, you put a Roman numeral 1 after both of these guys is that they were indeed, there's at least one other Muawiyah, at least one other Yazid. I don't remember how many there are, but they are the first of those names. And this is the beginning, really, of the actual, caliphate that's underlying so much of Islamic history. You may know that the Umayyads were, they ruled, well, let me see, what I need to do is, I don't know, I kind of boxed myself into a corner here. I have dates for them, I'll just put it underneath here. So the Umayyads ruled in Damascus from 661 to 749. But they were overthrown by the Abbasids. And let me get that up there. By the Abbasids. And they moved the capital of Baghdad from Damascus. They're 749 to 1258. Then the Umayyads, they were not done. They took refuge in Spain, and they broke off from the Abbasid caliphate, founded their own with the capital at Cordoba. And so that second set of dates is 756 to 1031. The Abbasids were eventually overthrown by the Mongols. So, they were in power for quite a long time. By the time you get to the early 10th century, we actually have three caliphates, and there's the third one's the Fatimids. That's a dot. Fatimids. And let's see now. Their date's 909. Can you see this low? I don't know if you can or not. 909 to 1171. So, like I say, by the early 10th century, then we have three caliphates altogether. We have in the west, centered at Cordoba, we have the Umayyads. Then at Cairo, we have the Fatimids. And then at Baghdad, basically encompassing the Near East, we have the Abbasids. Now, this is an exercise that I did with my two classes at Ali. I'm not going to stand up here and draw a map. If we were in our room, of course, what I would do is I would pull down the map and find the correct one. But I just ask you to paint a middle picture of the Roman Empire with the Mediterranean in the middle as sort of the Roman lake, as it were. And then I want you to imagine a vertical line right through the Adriatic, right between Greece and Rome, Greece and Italy, right between Greece and Italy, a vertical line there, which divides the empire pretty much into its two ethnic components, right? And as a matter of fact, when Diocletian came along in the late 3rd century and put an end to the chaos that was the 3rd century in Rome, where you had a new ruler every 3 or so years, he divided the empire in precisely that way. He decided it was just too administratively difficult for one person to handle the entire Roman Empire, and he set up 2 emperors, one in the east and one in the west. But that really tracked the sort of the cultural difference too between the 2 parts of the Roman Empire. The eastern part was very old and it had been civilized for the longest time, and of course it was largely, at least the western part, of the Alexandrian Empire, Alexander the Great's empire. The West, the Romans had actually civilized, you might say, brought culture to the Gauls and the Britons and so forth. And the lingua franca there was Latin, whereas the lingua franca in the East was Greek. So that vertical line, that split, really made some sense. The empire was occasionally still united by one ruler, Constantine, for example, or Theodosius. Was the ruler of the United Empire for a time. But most of the time, it was split between a Western emperor and an Eastern emperor. Well, anyway, I want you then, mentally, after that little exercise, to draw a horizontal line now, starting in the Pyrenees, extending across the Mediterranean, and ending on the east side, somewhere between like Syria and Asia Minor, so that general direction. Well, now you've split the Roman Empire into 4 quadrants. And the northwest quadrant, so now situate yourself in the 8th, 9th, 10th centuries. The northwest quadrant is a bunch of Germanic kingdoms and princedoms, right? I mean, the only thing resembling a nation-state by this time is France. But you got these little principalities here and there. The old Roman Empire no longer exists. It's been replaced by all these Germanic kingdoms. The northeast quadrant is the Eastern Roman Empire. It's still there. We call it the Byzantine Empire. It lasts until 1453. You know, so and civilization there, the culture, very, very continuous. No great break there. The whole point, though, is that the entire southern half of what used to be the Roman Empire, the southwest and the southeast quadrants, that's what is Islamic now. So that's really important. I'm not going to take the story any farther than that in my Ali classes this week. It just so happens. I mean, that's one of the reasons I want to do the Quran here, because I'm doing medieval philosophy in my Ali classes, and I gave the same little... a little imaginative presentation there just this week, of course, as you know, what happened that's really of interest from the history of philosophy is that because in the East, the areas that had been conquered by the Arabs were so highly civilized and cultured and had such a rich culture, the opposites very wisely devoted, I guess you'd say, a lot of public expenditure to translating works from from Greek into Arabic, notably the writings of Aristotle. And it was like scattering seed out on fertile ground. I mean, there's this explosion of culture, an explosion of philosophic thought in the Islamic world, while Western Europe was still very disunified with all these little Germanic principalities. That area finally got its act together, and I guess you'd say, you could explain it partly economically. I mean, the economy just tanked when the Western Roman Empire was overrun by the Germanic tribes. It took centuries for prosperity to return, but when prosperity did return, universities could be founded. And it, paradoxically, about the same time that really free thought, I would say, in the Islamic world was starting to get squelched by conservative reactions. About that same time, the writings of Aristotle and other writings got translated into Latin, and the same thing happened in Western Europe in the high Middle Ages. It's like scattering seed on fertile ground. You had Thomas Aquinas and all the others that were the result of those same the translations of those same works now available to Western Europe in the form of Latin. So isn't that interesting? So there's this long history from as early as the 9th century on until basically the Black Death, until the mid-14th century. Whenever the writings of Aristotle got translated into X, immediately there's an explosion of thought in that cultural region. And because these were different civilizations from antiquity, they really had different problems to some extent that they were dealing with. And so it wasn't just a matter of repeating what Aristotle had said, but rather of integrating Aristotelian ideas into this new civilization. So it's just a fascinating story to follow. I mean, I just finished this last week talking about Al-Farabi, who was the first of the great Islamic philosophers. And it's to him, I think, that we owe the initial integration of Aristotelianism, infused, by the way, with a little bit of Neoplatonism. But anyway, into the Islamic world. And his successors pretty much followed his example. And then, of course, around 1200, as I say, the same thing happened in Western Europe. Those writings got translated into Latin, and then we have the rise of scholastic philosophy in the 13th century on into the first half of the 14th. So it's really, really, really neat. I'm going way, way beyond the Quran. So I did want to go a little bit farther so you could see the historical. One other thing, though, I did want to say. So on the Shiite-Sunni split, the Shiites contend, of course, then, that the proper successor of the Prophet has got to be somebody related somehow. And so they have a completely different list of who the proper successor is. And we're going to use the term here, imam, which you're familiar with. Who is the imam, the authoritative figure, who is like the Pope almost? Who is the authoritative figure who follows the Prophet? It's got to be one all the time. And obviously, for the Shiite party, the first one was Ali. I mean, Abu Bakr, Umar, and Uthman were imposters, maybe. I don't know. They were not legitimate. Ali was imam number one. Imam number two was Hassan. Imam number three was Hussein, and so forth and so on. Now, the Shiite splinter group itself splintered. They all agreed that that the imam currently is nowhere to be found. The current imam is there, but is nowhere to be found, because the last imam went into occultation. Went into hiding. But which one? And this is where the Shiite sect, in turn, split into some other groups. Was it the fifth imam? Was it the seventh imam? Was it the 12th imam? There were fivers, seveners, and twelvers. The fivers are the Zaydis. Let me just make sure. Zay, I believe. Zay. And then the Ismailis. Let me make sure I get all my vowels right here. Isma. Ismaili. As you can see, there's a lot of And then the imamis, which are the that's also a yeah. The Iranian version of Shiism is 12er. So they're imami. I betcha, but I have never looked it up. I keep on meaning to, and I keep on forgetting to do it. But I'll betcha that the Houthis, I bet they're Zaydis. I'll bet. Because I have read that the Fivers were prominent in Yemen. So I'm guessing that they would be Fiver. Neither the Fiver nor the Twelver group was the most dominant, though, in the Middle Ages. It was the Ismailis who were in the Middle Ages were the most dominant. When Al-Ghazali wrote his refutations of the philosophers and of the Shiites, it's the Ismaili version of Shiism that he directs his refutation to. So they were the most prominent group during that period, even if nowadays, I guess it's mainly the Twelvers, but because of the Iranians that are the most prominent Shiite group. But anyway,
what about the Alawites in Syria?
You know, they're right. Yeah, there are other groups. I'm not sure which one they're most similar to. Maybe the Ismailis. Maybe they're Seveners. I don't know. Do you know? What?
No, I don't.
Yeah. Let me read you the list of the 12. Not that these names mean much to you, but this is the list, the complete list of the 12 possibilities. The only difference being that the Fivers would simply say, you chop it off at number 5, and the Seveners would say, you chop it off at number 7, whereas the Twelver would say, no, no, this is the complete list. The first one's Ali, then Hassan, and Hussein, as I said. And then you got Ali the second, another Ali, and then a Muhammad the first, and then a Jafar, and then a Musa, another Ali, another Muhammad, another Ali, another Hassan, and then finally a guy named Hujat Allah. So that's your 12 possible imams, but exactly which one went into occultation? Well, the Fivers would say it's Muhammad, the first. The Seveners would say, no, it's Musa. And then the Twelvers would say it's the last one, Hujat Allah. So that's the way that came out.
Can I ask a question, Ron?
Yeah, yeah.
The occultation, does that mean that he is floating around in the ether somewhere?
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that.
And he will be an unknown.
But he will return. You see, there's a second coming part of Shiism. There's a second coming part of Shiite theology, really. Not unlike the Christian second coming. And this is the Mahdi. I forgot. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. Now the question is, exactly how do I spell that? I'm sure I wrote it down somewhere. But I don't know. I don't think I have it written down, so I'm not sure. Anyway, it's spelled, but I'm not sure if there's a long vowel in there or not. And I don't believe I have it. I thought I did. Sure don't say. Oh, here it is. No, a long I. Mahdi. So yeah, that's like the second coming of Christ. So we Shiites now, we're expecting the hidden imam at some point in history, at the end of time, to return and set everything right and all that sort of thing. So yeah, so very interesting parallel there. I'm glad you asked that question, Marty, because I totally forgot to mention that.
Hey Don, can I slip in a question here?
Sure.
If I understood correctly what you said, it's that the Muslims moved into northern Africa and Spain more to because of their internal split and needing to get their own space rather than a desire to conquer the non-believers who were in those other locations.
No, I don't think that's... I didn't mean to necessarily suggest that. I mean, certainly it was a military conquest throughout North Africa, Spain, and the Near East. But I was talking about the Umayyads. When the Umayyads lost power to the Abbasids, in, what, 749, they didn't give up, and they took root again in Cordoba.
And so, but, I mean, there's a difference between whether you go there because you lost in your home territory or your desire to spread your religion and take over the others.
Well, you lost in your home. No, but I mean, but it was already under Islamic rule. That was just a part of the empire, I guess you could say, that they were able to occupy and defend against the Abbasids and break away from the Abbasid caliphate.
I'm trying to understand why what was a very regional group, these various nomadic tribes and so on, suddenly decided that they wanted to conquer all that space that they had historically zero interest in.
Well, like I said, I mean, that is the thing. I mean, you know, the early surahs in the Quran, the Meccan surahs, there's nothing about warfare, really, in the surahs. It's when he fled to Medina, the Meccans tried to snuff the whole business out militarily. The Medinans struck back. I don't know. It's like something clicked at that point, and you're on this roll. And once you've started this military campaign, it's like the inertia just keeps going. And where does it stop? Well, it's only going to stop when you're absolutely prevented by an outside force from getting any farther. Did I answer your question?
I guess. I mean, it didn't seem like they were exercising the will of the Prophet by taking over Spain and Northern Africa.
But it's not just a military thing. It's a military and proselytizing thing. I mean, the two are identical. They go hand in hand. We need to spread the word that, you know, we need to spread the new religion. I mean, isn't that kind of typical? One way to do it is through missionary work. Another way to do it is through military means. In the history of Christianity,
when the Mongols took over space, they didn't do it for religious reasons.
True, they didn't, but the Christians did in some cases. Okay. Right? Charlemagne did.
Yeah.
You know, he'd march a defeated tribe into the next nearest river and baptize the whole business, you know. But sometimes it was done peacefully. I mean, it's just various ways. Now, of course, there are we're in the thick of political issues here, and you know, some people will absolutely insist that no, it was all peaceful. They spread the word, and people saw how superior Islam was to Christianity. They converted en masse. That just is not true. But I will say that they did tend to be very tolerant. If you could convince them that you were a people of the book, then they would pretty much let you alone. You'd have to pay a tax, but you could practice your own religion.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
To get back to the four righteous caliphs.
Yeah.
We understand, I think, that Muhammad had no sons.
Mm-hmm.
So do we know, were they relatives of his but not sons?
The only one that was part of the family was Ali, number four.
And that was, I think, his daughter Fatima's son.
I think it's his wife. His daughter's wife. Husband. You know what I'm saying. Ali is his son-in-law, what I meant to say.
But we don't.
Muhammad had sons; they just didn't survive to
adulthood. That's right. He had six children in all, and the sons all died, I think. Did I interrupt you, Marty? Were you starting to say something else?
Just that we don't know where we assume they were relatives of his, the four righteous caliphs.
No, the first three were not. That's the whole point.
Okay.
Yeah. Anything else? Okay, then. Well, we have maybe 10 minutes. I want to give you an overview of the prophets, the 25 prophets that we're going to be talking about in detail. I guess I won't open up the Quran today, but I will read one before I do anything else, let me just read. It's 10:48. Yeah. I want to read you the 48th verse of Surah 10. And this is the way it goes. This is the key idea. And for every people, there is a messenger. So when their messenger comes, it is judged between them with equity, and they are not wronged. For every people, there is a messenger. Remember what I said early on, that you know, God is just. God has, therefore, certain expectations for people. God wants them to be just. It wouldn't be fair to reward or punish them if they didn't know what those expectations were. Therefore, we send a messenger. But it also wouldn't be fair if somebody was left out. So, for every people, and not individual, I also said this at the time, the Quran seems to be thinking more about groups, but for every people, there is a messenger who has delivered the word of God and let you know what is expected of you. And that's the prophets. Now, you might say, well, how about the Chinese? I mean, are any of these 25 prophets, do they go to China or India or, you know, the South Sea Islands? Well, probably not. But maybe there were others. I'm sure that's what a Muslim would say. There were probably others, too, besides these 25. But these 25 are the sort of they're the official ones. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to put up on the board the transliteration of the Arabic name, and I want you to tell me. I got too many. Here we go. Pieces of paper here, and I want you to tell me who this is, because every single one of them has been identified with a biblical, except for Muhammad, of course, with a big biblical figure. So the first one's easy. You know who that is, right? Don't have to do a quiz on that one. This is not Jeopardy. Alright. First prophet is Adam. And of course you might say, well, whom did Adam prophesy to? Eve or something? But of course he lived to be, what, 930 or whatever, so he had a lot of great, 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 etc. grandchildren, I guess he could prophesy to. Okay, the next one. Next one. Idris. Any theories on who that would be? I should have opened this up. Anybody? Nobody wants to guess?
Ishmael?
No, you're okay. No, you're way too far into the future. Well, let me read from the Bible. This is in chapter 5 of Genesis. Let's see now. So, this is the book of the generations of Adam. And then there's all this stuff, kind of real quick recap of Adam. Then when Adam lived 130 years, he became the father and of a son in his own likeness, after his image and his name. Seth, of course. The days of Adam after he became the father of Seth were 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. When Seth had lived 105 years, he became the father of Enosh. Seth lived after the birth of Enosh 807 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. When Enosh had lived 90 years, he became the father of Kenan. Enosh lived after the birth of Kenan 815 years, etc., etc., etc. Okay, wait a minute now. So somewhere down here. So then, Kenan had lived 70 years. He became the father of Mahalalel. when Mahalalel, rather, had lived 65 years, I'm skipping stuff here, he became the father of Jared. When Jared had lived 162 years, he became the father of Enoch. And then Jared lived a blah, blah, blah. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. And then he's the only guy, now we have any further information other than begat type information here. It says, Enoch walked with God after the birth of Methuselah 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. So Enoch was one of the few who didn't just plain old die, was translated, say, into heaven. Well, anyway, Idris is Enoch. It's Enoch. So,
that's not immediately obvious, is it?
He's number two. Number three. Oh, you can get this one. Who would that be?
Noah.
Yep.
Noah.
All right, here's another one that's a little bit difficult. I'm going to do the next two, and actually both of these. This is the dot. We got Hud and we got Sali. Now this is really getting into the weeds. This is in chapter 11, I remember that. Like verse 13 or something. Yes, here we go. Now, the only weird thing, though, I mean, okay, this is the descendant. This is after Noah, of course. And this is the descendants, ultimately, of Shem. And these are the descendants, beginning at verse 10. These are the descendants of Shem. When he was 100 years old, he's the father of Arpachshad. And then, blah, blah, blah. When Arpachshad had lived 35 years, he became the father of Shelah. Blah, blah, blah. When Shelah had lived 30 years, he became the father of Eber. And Eber then was the father of Peleg. Peleg was the father of Reu. Reu was the father of Serug, who was the father of Nahor and Terah. Now, you know about Terah. But at any rate, even though they're in the reverse order here, we have Hud is identified with Eber, who in the Bible is the son of Shelah. So these two are reversed chronologically in the Bible, but this is the order, the traditional order of the Islamic prophets. So we have, you know, when you're reading along in the Quran, there's quite a bit of stuff on Hud and Sali. And you think, well, who are they? And yet they have been identified with biblical figures. But that's the sum of what you find in the Bible, what I just read you on those two guys. So quite a bit more information from the Quran. Well, let me go on. Now, here's another easy one. I think pretty much from here on. Ibrahim. Right?
Abraham.
And, And this has got a dot under it. Oh, long U. Lut. Connected with Abraham.
Isaac.
No.
Lot.
Yeah, Isaac's coming up. In just a second.
There's Ishmael.
Yep. And then we have
Isaac.
Yep.
Isaac.
And then we have
Jacob.
Very good. And then we have
Joseph.
Yes. And then we have, and this is a little harder, but it's possible. Who do you think that is? Job. Alas, I'm going to have to quit. Darn it. So we've gotten down to, 12, the first 12 of the 25. So we've gotten halfway through. Oh, nuts. Well, sorry. I wish we could keep on going for another 15 minutes or so. But it's 2 minutes till. So we're going to have to quit. So next week, we'll pick up after Job. And there's Shu'aib, Musa, Haran, Daoud, Suleiman, Elias, Elisa, Yunus, Zulkifli, Zachariah, Yahya, Isa, and Muhammad. That's what's coming up. But anyway, more next week. See ya.
Thanks, Don.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Sure.
Have a good week.
You too.
Bye, Don.
Bye-bye.
You.